as it dawned the morning. There were thunders and lightning. A great cloud settled on the mountain. The people trembled as they heard the voice of Elohim's own words. A sound of a ram's horn blasting. You shall be a kingdom of priests. You shall be a...
Shalom Aleichem, Mish Bakash, Time Tamer here with Paradigm Shift, and thank you again so much for joining us today. As always, we want to give all glory, thanksgiving, honor, and praise and worship and everything in of ourselves to the Father of our forefathers, Yahuwah El, who sits in the heaven of heavens with our King, Yahushua HaMashiach, sitting at his right hand, waiting for his enemies to be made his footstool.
Yahuwah Sali, Umetu Dati, Umefati Ali, Zuri Ekasebo. Yah is my rock and my fortress and my deliverer, my El, my rock in whom I shall find refuge.
Not
this
really.
Is Worlds in Collision, Part 19, and we're going to need some refuge, Mishpacha.
That's right, Mishpacha. So well, we're going to start off here today. We're going to cover more of Worlds in Collision today and do less bantering and chattering and talking. So if we can help ourselves, we will, with Yah's blessing. And... okay, Mama. Okay, I'm going to read to you a couple of witnesses of discoveries. Discoveries, this comes from Jonathan Gray's. Actually, I'll let Mama read this.
Sorry,
this
I had to kick from, a cat out.
Yeah, she's knocking things everywhere.
There was no way we're going to get through this show without a big crash.
Uh-huh. Jeez. So anyway, this is Jonathan. That's from Jonathan Gray's blog. He's an Australian, I believe he's Australian, either Australian or New Zealand researcher and writer into these types of matters. Now I've never seen him quote or talk about Velikovsky. We did get a couple of his books, which we are going to read at some point in time. But anyway, he's showing the evidence of these discovered cities that are 3,000 to 6,000 feet underneath the oceans. The oceans of the world, Mishpacha.
Which proves Velikovsky's premise that he took from all the ancients about great conflagrations, which absolutely turned the world upside down. Isaiah's whole premise about the earth moving back into to and fro like a drunkard, that's real, guys. It really, really happened. And it didn't happen just one time. It happened more than once. And it's going to happen again. Mm-hmm. And when that stuff happens, this is how you get cities 6,000 feet under the sea and how you get cities at, you know, 13,000 feet high in the sky. And
that's
you get,
right.
like, marine mammals up there and stuff.
And you get mammals, and you get like things like hippopotamuses and elephants and reindeers and lions and woolly mammoths and
buffalo
people and
all in one place,
tools and stuff, all mangled together, like in the coast of Alaska, where they dig for gold and dredge in the trenches and stuff. They find all these things mangled together because a great wave came in and just destroyed everything and piled them all up together. In Alaska, hippopotamus in Alaska, these same type of animals are piled by the millions in places in Europe and Great Britain. If you read Earth and Upheaval from Velikovsky, you see all these... the head geologists and paleontologists of the 18th century that are reporting on these things, these finds, and they sent these ships out all over the world, the British Empire did, and the Europeans, because they wanted to hoard all this knowledge away so the people wouldn't know what was going on.
What do you think the Smithsonian's for?
The Smithsonian confiscated all artifacts of any kind of pre-flood giants and evidence of the flood and the giants and their lives when the United States of America was conquered in our ignorance against our own Israelite people and Egyptian and Syrian peoples and Romans that came here many times over the centuries since David and Solomon's empire. And then there was vast periods where this continent was disconnected from the mainland or the main of Europe and the Middle East during each time an empire fell. So anyway, in Great Britain and England, France, Germany, you have all these things piled together that shouldn't, animals that don't live together on
this
earth.
And in the Arctic basins and stuff too, they have them too.
And in Siberia, you actually find even more of these animals piled together in great piles and things. You know, you find these woolly mammoths that are froze instantly with food still in their mouths, Mishpachat.
They're digging them up. They fed them to their dogs.
And eating steaks from them themselves.
The flesh was still good.
So these things have only happened a few thousand years ago, Mishpachat.
And the cold happened so fast, it was like a flash freeze.
That's right. So what happened at that time, and in our opinion for all that, with these great geologists and things, the 1700s and 1800s, and these ships that they sent out, to research and try to find these cities and civilizations, continents that completely sunk, you know, everyone, then they get you all fixated on Atlantis and how woo-woo-woo that is, and they get you thinking about aliens instead of the actual actions and the reasons why these things took place. As our scripture tells us, every man's heart became evil continuously, thought evil continuously, and Abba decided to destroy the earth with a great deluge and a flood.
Judgment.
So the canopy of water that was over the earth with the pristine environment, like a greenhouse effect, and then the fountains of deep broke open from under the earth. Water came down in great deluge, and we lost that canopy above, and the whole environmental situation on earth has been in total degrading, total evolutionary degradation from since the flood. The earth has become less and less inhabitable, and our lifespans have become shorter and shorter as a result of it, and that's how he capped our age at 120 years max. So, anyway.
All right, so let's read this. Deep Sea Discoveries. The Swedish research ship Albatross had just returned from a peaceful reconnaissance in the South Atlantic. Had you peeped through a lattice window in a little house outside Stockholm, you might have seen two men, one of them bearded, huddled across a table, engaged in lively talk. One of them, in fact, looked almost wild-eyed. But knowing him as a well-balanced, sober man, you would have to admit that whatever it was that now had him so excited must be something extraordinary. I swear to you, it's incredible. Do you know we were sounding the seabed 700 miles east of Brazil, and we brought up core samples of fresh water plants? Can you believe that? And do you know how deep they were? 3,000 meters. The speaker was Professor Hans Petersen, who had led the expedition. And he added, these samples actually contained microorganisms, twigs, plants, and even tree bark. Within a similar time frame, discussion was hot in London.
That was coral. That was 9,000 feet below the ocean. 3,000 meters. 3 times 3,000. 9,000 feet below the ocean surface.
So here's this other discovery. Coral had been recovered from depths of over 3,000 feet in the mid-Atlantic Ocean sites. Now we all know that coral grows only close to sea level. So in London, England, someone else was making a chilling diagnosis. Either the seabed dropped thousands of feet, or the sea rose mightily. Meanwhile, at Columbia University in the USA, Professor Maurice Ewig, a prominent marine geologist, was reporting on an expedition that had descended to submerged plateaus at a depth of 5,000 feet. It's quite amazing, he said. At 5,000 feet down, they discovered prehistoric beach sand. It was brought up in one case from a depth of nearly 3.5 miles, far from any place where beaches exist today. One deposit was 1,200 miles from the nearest land. As we all know, sandy beaches form from waves breaking on the edge of the coastal rim of seas. Beach sand does not form deep down on the ocean bottom. Then Ewig dropped his bombshell. Either the land must have sunk 2 or 3 miles, or the sea must have been 2 or 3 miles lower than now. Either conclusion is startling. What this means. These facts mean one of two things. Either there was a mighty ocean bed subsidence, unexplainable by orthodox science, or a huge, likewise unexplained, addition of water to the ocean. Data strongly suggest that the sea level actually was several thousand feet lower than at present, that there was less water in the ocean at one time. These discoveries suggest that we are uncovering evidence of a former sea level. But this would call for a relatively sudden increase of 30% in the volume of the ocean. The compelling question is, where did this water come from? Few geologists can bring themselves to answer this. Obviously, melting ice sheets could never have contained enough water to raise the ocean level thousands of feet. So, we can forget melting ice sheets being the cause. City on the seabed? Well, now for another surprise. This time from the excitement's in the Pacific. The year was 1965. A research vessel named Anton Brun was investigating the Nazca Trench off Peru. The sonar operator called for the captain. I don't know what to make of this, he murmured. Around here, the ocean floor is all mud bottom. But just take in these sonar readings. Unusual shapes on the ocean floor. I'm puzzled. Better lower a camera, came the order. At a depth of 6,000 feet, a photograph revealed huge upright pillars and walls, some of which seemed to have writing on them. In other nearby locations, apparently artificially shaped stones lay on their sides, as though they had toppled over. The crew rubbed their eyes and kept staring. Could this really be the remains of a city under a mass of water more than a mile deep? Was it overwhelmed suddenly by some gigantic disaster, and now it was buried under 6,000 feet of ocean?
It's pretty amazing.
Just a few of them.
Pretty amazing. Hallelujah. And those were the research ships. And, you know, they did a lot of this research back in the early, late 1800s and early 1800s and early 1900s, and then they quit it. You know, and then they squirreled it all away, and they make sure that you don't hear anything about it today, especially on their Illuminati mass-controlled, mind-controlled media. Okay, so where we left off in part 18 of Worlds in Collision, we were talking about the mythologization.
Mythological?
Of all of the ancients' testimonies to these cataclysms that have taken place from the flood to, you know, many other things in our scriptures, especially the Exodus that was witnessed by all the people all over the earth, and that's what this book primarily talks about and gives all the ancient testimonies. You cannot come to any other conclusion other than what Velikovsky has testified and witnessed to, because he simply poses questions and then presents all the witnesses from across the globe. And they witness to every single one of the plagues, Mishpachah, and hearing the voice of Yah. So we're going to continue on with this section on the mythology of folklore. In the section, Venus in the Folklore of the Indians, a few illustrations were offered to illuminate this thesis. In order to illustrate it with additional examples, we choose the nature folklorist motif of the sun being arrested in its movement across the firmament in the tales of the Polynesians, Hawaiians, and North American Indians. The best known legend cycle on the Pacific Islands is that which has for its hero the semigod Mau. Or Maui. I think it's Maui. M-A-U-I. That's Maui,
yeah,
right? Yeah, Maui. This cycle comprises a trilogy. Quote, of the many exploits of Maui, three seem to be most widely spread. They are fishing up of the land, snaring the sun, and the quest of fire. End quote. There are two versions of this cycle, one in New Zealand and one in Hawaii, but both are variants of a common tradition. The Hawaiian version of the snaring of the sun runs thus, quote, Maui's mother was much troubled by the shortness of the day, occasioned by the rapid movement of the sun, and since it was impossible to dry properly the sheets of tapa used for clothing, the hero resolved to cut off the legs of the sun so that he could not travel fast. Maui now went off eastward to where the sun climbed daily out of the underworld, and as the luminary came up, the hero noosed his legs one after the other and tied the rope strongly to great trees. Fairly caught, the sun could not get away, and Maui gave him a tremendous beating with his magic weapon. To save his life, the sun begged for mercy, and on promising to go more slowly ever after, was released from his bonds. The fishing up of islands, or the appearance of new islands, took place at the same time. The causal relation to the cosmic change in the sky is evident. In one of the versions told in Polynesia about the fishing up of the islands, it is said that a star was used as bait. The following is a tale told by Menominee Indians, an Algonquin tribe. Quote, the little boy made a noose and stretched it across the path, and when the sun came to that point, the noose caught him around the neck and began to choke him until he almost lost his breath. It became dark, and the sun called out to the Manitos, help me, my brothers, and cut this string before it kills me. The Manitos came, but the thread had so cut into the flesh of the sun's neck that they could not sever it. When all but one had given up, the sun called to the mouse to try to cut the string. The mouse came up and gnawed at the string, but it was difficult to work because the string was hot and deeply embedded in the sun's neck. After working at the string a good while, however, the mouse succeeded in cutting it. When the sun breathed again and the darkness disappeared. If the mouse had not succeeded, the sun would have died. Now, doesn't that remind you of a bedtime story or the fable stories that we were taught as little children? Wasn't there a lion? Oh no, he had a thorn in his paw, and a mouse comes along and pulls it out of his paw, right?
Right.
Okay. So I don't know if you know Mishpachah, but in Egyptian religion and mythology, They have worshipped the mouse for thousands of years for these type, for the same type of incident, type of stories. The story about snaring the sun associates itself in our mind with one of the occasions when the sun was disrupted in its movements across the sky. The story contains an important detail and enables us to understand a natural phenomena. In a previous section, we discussed the various versions of the annihilation of Sennacherib's. How you say it, Mama? Sennacherib's army. Excuse me. And the physical phenomena which caused it. According to the scriptures, he capitalizes that word. I love that. In the days of Isaiah, the sun was interrupted in its course, turning back 10 degrees on the sundial. That night, the army of Sennacherib was destroyed by a blast. In Egypt, this victory over the common enemy of the Jews and the Egyptians was observed in a festival at Letopis, the city of the thunderbolt, the holy animal. The holy animal of the city was a mouse. Now he just goes into this. And bronze mice inscribed with the prayers of pilgrims are found in its soil. Herodotus saw there a statue of a god with a mouse in his hand, commemorating the annihilation of the army of Sennacherib. The story he heard gave as the cause of the event an invasion of mice that gnawed the strings of the bows. He also told the story of the changed movements of the sun directly following the record of the destruction of the Assyrian army. We recognize that the image of the mouse must have had some relation to the cosmic drama. The best we could do was to interpret the mouse as a symbol of a simultaneous plague exemplified by the illness of King Hezekiah. The tale of the Indians that combines the snaring of the sun with the deed of the mouse explains the relation of these two elements to each other. Apparently, the atmosphere of the celestial body that appeared in the darkness and was illuminated took on the elongated form of a mouse. This explains why the blast that destroyed the army of Sennacherib was commemorated by the emblem of a mouse. The Indian tale grew from the picture on the celestial screen where a great mouse freed the snared sun. Thus we see how a folk story of the apprentice can solve an unsettled problem between Isaiah and Herodotus. A four-legged animal in the sky approaching the sun was visualized as a mouse by the Egyptians and the Menominee Indians. In the tale of the southern Ute Indians, the cottontail is the animal that is connected with the disruption of the movement of the sun. He went to the east with the intention of breaking the sun in pieces. There he waited for the sun to rise. Quote, "The sun began to rise, but seeing the cottontail, it went down again. Then it rose slowly again and did not notice the animal. He struck the sun with his club, breaking off a piece, which touched the ground and set fire to the world. The fire pursued Cottontail, who began to flee. He ran to a log and asked if it would save him if he got inside. No, I burn up entirely. So he ran again and asked a rock with a cleft in it. No, I cannot save you. When I am heated, I burst. At last, he got to a river. The river said, no, I cannot save you. I'll boil and you will get boiled. On the plain, Cottontail ran through the weed, but the fire came very close. The weed burned and fell on his neck. Where cottontails are yellow now. From everywhere he saw smoke rising. He walked a little way on the hot ground, and one of his legs was burned up to the knee. Before that, he had been long-legged. He walked on two legs, and one of them burned off. He jumped on one till that also burned off. In this version of the attack on the sun, two points worthy of mention are the world fire following the disruption in the movement of the sun and the change of the world of animals accompanied by strong mutations. In the section Phaethion, we wondered how the Roman poet Ovid could have known of the relation between the interrupted movement of the sun and a world fire unless such a catastrophe had really occurred. The same reasoning applies to the Indians. The story of the snaring of the sun or attacking the sun is told in many variants, but the world fire is a consistent result. Forests and fields burn, mountains smoke and vomit lava, rivers boil, caves in the mountains collapse, and rocks burst when the sun peeps above the horizon and then disappears and again comes over the horizon. There is one instance more in the Indian story of the sun being impeded on its path and the ensuing world conflagration. Before the catastrophe, quote, "The sun used to go around close to the ground. The purpose of the attack on the sun was to make the sun shine a little longer. The days are too short. After the catastrophe, the days became longer. the ancestors of the Shoshonean Indians, a tribe of Utah, Colorado, and Nevada, appear to have lived in the days of Sennacherib.
Yeah, it's fine.
Okay. And Hezekiah at such a longitude that the sun was just on the eastern horizon when it changed its direction and went back and then came up again. So, okay, we're now going on chapter 7, and this is about poles, the earth's poles uprooted.
What changes in the motion of the earth, moon, and Mars resulted from the contacts in the 8th and 7th centuries, meaning the conflagrations? The moon, being smaller than Mars, would have been greatly influenced by Mars if it came close enough to that planet. It could have been drawn nearer to the earth or pulled away to a more remote orbit. It is therefore of interest to investigate whether, in the time shortly after 687, reforms of the lunar calendar were undertaken. Also, the Earth could have been removed from her place, which would have meant a change in the orbital circumference and thus in the length of the year, or in the inclination of the terrestrial axis to the plane of the ecliptic, and thus in the seasons, in the position of the poles on the terrestrial globe, in the velocity of axial rotation, and in the length of day, and so on. Some of these changes could be traced if a chart of the sky drawn in a period prior to 687 could be examined. Such a chart does not exist. It's painted on the ceiling of the tomb of Senmut, the Egyptian. Such a chart does exist. It is painted on the ceiling of the tomb of Senmut, the Egyptian vizier. As explained previously, the tomb dates from a time following the Exodus, but before the days of Amos and Isaiah. The charts of Senmut show the sky over Egypt at two different epochs, or epochs. One of them depicts the sky of Egypt before the poles were interchanged, probably in the catastrophe that terminated the Middle Kingdom. The other represents the sky of Egypt in the lifetime of Senmut. The first chart startled the investigators, because in it, west and east are reversed. Their judgment of the other chart, in which west and east are not reversed, is as follows, quote, "It is surprising to find that the celestial charts, which have been preserved until our time, did not correspond to direct observations, nor to the calculations made at the moments of erection of the monument on which these charts are pictured." Modern astronomy does not admit or even consider the possibility that at some historical time east and west as well as south and north were reversed. Consequently, the first chart could not have been interpreted at all. The other chart, with its displaced constellations, suggested to the author of the above quotation that it depicted some more ancient tradition. The only change, according to modern astronomy, comes from the precession of the equinoxes, or the slow movement of the polar axis, which describes a circle in the course of about 26,000 years. The computation of the precession is insufficient by far to explain the position of the constellations on the chart, if we rely on the conventional chronology, and even more so if we follow the revised chronology, which brings the age of Senmut and Queen closer to modern times. The changes
then was the Queen of Sheba.
Okay. Changes in the geographical position and cosmic direction of the poles caused by the catastrophes of the 8th and 7th centuries, as well as those brought about by the catastrophes of the 15th century, can be studied with the help of the astronomical charts of Senmut. According to Seneca, the Great Bear has been the polar constellation. After a cosmic upheaval shifted the sky, a star of the Little Bear became the polar star. Hindu astronomical tablets composed by the Brahmins in the first half of the first millennium before the present era show a uniform deviation from the expected position of the stars at the time the observations were made, the precession of the equinoxes being taken into consideration. Modern scholars wondered at this, in their opinion, inexplicable error. In view of the geometrical methods employed by Hindu astronomy and its detailed method of calculation, a mistaken observation equal to even a fraction of a degree would be difficult to account for. In the Jimaniya Upanishad Brahmana, it is written that the center of the sky, or the point around which the firmament revolves, is in the Great Bear. This is the same statement we found in Thyestes of Seneca. In Egypt, too, the Great Bear played the part of the pole star. The Great Bear never set. Could it be that the precession of equinoxes shifted the direction of the axis so that... Oh, we're ending. Okay, next time.
Yeah, okay. That's it. You might as well close that up.
Nope.
Okay, very good. So keep looking up Mitch Pacai, and we're going to continue with Mark.
20, I think.
20 of World of Religion in the next show. So keep looking up everything. Mitch Pacai, hallelujah. Keep it ruling. Respect your father and your mother. You shall not murder. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. You shall not covet.